to continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 5535, the Public Defense Services Commission. And I'd like to bring up Ms. Swenson, if you could continue on. And Rudden, did you want to mention anything at all?
Mr. Chair, members, the agency did hand out the information that was requested yesterday, which was the major budget drivers, which the subcommittee had requested.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to respond very quickly to some of the other issues that came up yesterday. And although Senator Westland isn't here yet, he was the one who asked about the percentage of the total caseload that's handled by public defense providers. And as the chief had reported, for felonies, that's approximately 90%. We determined that for misdemeanors, it's approximately, and it is certainly not an accurate figure, is 55% approximately for misdemeanors. That doesn't mean that people are retaining counsel who don't have court-appointed counsel. Many of them, especially at the misdemeanor level, are simply representing themselves or not being represented in proceedings. Secondly, there was a request by Representative Hanna for some more information about the time it takes to fill vacancies by our contractors. And if that's of interest to the other members, I'd be happy to go over it, or I can provide it to him.
I'm sorry, I was distracted.
Oh, forgive me.
Tell me the last bit. Sorry.
Representative Hanna had asked for some more information about the average time it requires to fill vacancies as compared to approximately 6 years ago. And I have that data. I can provide it to him, or if the rest of the committee would like to hear, I'm glad to present that to all of you.
I'm interested, but why don't we wait till Representative Hanna gets
sure.
here, and maybe we'll get that at the end of that hearing.
Okay. And then I think the other items are addressed in the documents that you have. The first one, at Representative Nathanson's request, talks about the major budget drivers for public defense. The second document was at Senator Burdick's request, and this talks about expenditures in death penalty cases and the percentage of those expenditures as a portion of the public defense services account. There are three notes at the bottom that I draw your attention to, which qualify the information in that diagram. And then on the following page, there is a chart which basically talks about the increase in expenditures for death penalty cases for the last 10 years or five biennia. And you'll notice that the percentage of increase over that time increases slightly every biennium. And that was the fact that we were reporting to you that every year we have not only the new cases coming in, but many of the old cases remain in the system for a long time. So the number continues to grow, and the percentage of consumption of our resources continues to grow as well.
Ms. Swenson, can I ask you about that? Because I know a lot of our cases are now heading into the federal court. Your office, tell me how that affects your office. Does that mean that you no longer deal with the cases or have less work to do on those cases or more work to do?
Mr. Chair, it's my belief that currently two of them, there are four on the way, two have actually arrived in the federal system. At that level, the Federal Defender's Office defends those cases, so our funds are not utilized for that purpose.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another document, I know we have the numbers somewhere, but could you give me a ballpark estimate? Thank you very much for showing the expenses. And, for example, on the page with the pie chart that looks like this, it shows that 9.2% of the expenditures are aggravated murder, but the number of cases is something less than 9.2%.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, yes, absolutely. So a very
fraction.
Small number.
Yes. Okay.
And could I say, Catherine, approximately 25 per year? of new cases. We still have the old ones in the system, but mm-hmm. new ones, approximately 25 a year.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Let's roll along.
I'd like to introduce Peter Gartland, who's the chief defender and the director of our appellate unit.
Yes, question before we move on for Ms. Swenson. You mentioned that there's 25 new, what type of cases per year?
These are aggravated murder cases with a possible death sentence, yes.
With a possible death sentence.
Is it all aggravated murder cases?
Only with a possible death sentence.
There are, for example, juvenile cases that are not subject to the death penalty but can be filed as aggravated murder charges. But these are with death penalty attached.
Just to follow up, if I may, and so that's the ones that we actually are going through the system and being tried with the death penalty attached, or is that the ones that we could try for the death penalty being attached?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, there certainly are cases that are not charged that potentially could be charged as death penalty cases, and a decision can be made by a prosecutor prior to charging not to seek the death penalty. These are the cases where the prosecutor has filed charges and is seeking the death penalty.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Gartland. I'm the Chief Defender with the Legal Services Division of the Office of Public Defense Services, and I'm pleased to be here to discuss the representation that occurs after proceedings in the trial court are completed. And so the scope of my presentation will be about appeals in criminal cases, juvenile cases, civil commitment cases, parole cases, and all of PCR, post-conviction relief cases, so that would be both trial and appeals. And beginning with the materials, it may not be in the materials, but actually, although this is what I consider a very important area of law, the budget, the Office of Public Defense Services budget for these services is less than 10%. It's actually about 7%. So even though we're talking about important cases, it's not a large percentage of the budget. Now, despite constituting a relatively small portion of the budget, appellate cases have significant statewide importance beyond the individual case itself. Appellate opinions set precedential value for the trial courts. They impose uniformity, or set out uniformity for how the laws are supposed to work. Opinions affect how agencies work and governmental entities such as the police, parole board, DAs, and the attorney general. And this is something that perhaps you'd be unaware, because I was unaware of until I started practicing for a while, but the kind of representation in the cases that come out of these kind of indigent defense funded cases are really important for the quality of life for all Oregonians. And I know that may sound like a stretch, but let me give you an example. Last year we litigated a case in the Oregon Supreme Court, and it concerned what an officer can do during a traffic stop with respect to a passenger in a car. Now, a traffic stop is typically not for a criminal offense. It's for a speeding violation or for a turning violation. So it's a civil offense. The penalty might be $50, $100, whatever. And during this stop, the police officer was asking the passenger questions. What were you doing in the car? Can I see identification? What were you doing earlier that night? And so the Supreme Court ultimately ruled on that and ruled in our favor and said, well, those kind of questions, absent reasonable suspicion that the passenger has done something wrong, are really overreaching, and so the police are not supposed to be doing that. And, you know, when you think about it, you wouldn't think that criminal cases, particularly the irony is indigent defense-funded criminal cases, would have an impact on motorists statewide, but yet that occurs. And so these cases actually affect the quality of life for all Oregonians, not just people who are financially eligible for indigent defense services. I'd like to move on and discuss the appellate division, the legal services division, within the Office of Public Defense Services. And we provide mandated representation mandated by statute or the Constitution. And we represent clients from misdemeanor cases up through death penalty cases. And we also represent clients who are appealing board of parole decisions. And I'd like to give you a background a little bit about what an appellate attorney really does. You know, what's our function? And I see our function as we're structural engineers on the system. The idea is that the Constitution and the statutes create, let's talk about criminal law, a criminal justice system. And our function is to look at the proceedings below in the trial court and try to identify if a judge's ruling was defective, and did that defective ruling create an unfair trial or proceeding or an illegal sentence. So in a way, it is kind of a normative view of how the system should work in the trial court, and our task is to identify if there was a breakdown anywhere. So what we look at is we look at a trial judge's legal rulings. Now, what will happen is a case will come in, and an attorney in our office will receive that case, and will review the transcript. And the transcript could be anywhere from 30 pages to 10,000 pages, depending upon the length of the proceedings below and the complexity of the issues. If there are no viable issues, our attorneys will talk with the client and advise the client to dismiss. We advise the client, look, there are no appealable issues here, and you're not going to get relief. So we do some screening, do a lot of screening. And if the client doesn't take our advice, we file what's called a Balfour brief. And it's called a Balfour brief because that just happens to be the name of a particular person whose case was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court. But the Balfour brief essentially tells the Court of Appeals that we, the attorney, has reviewed the record, but we cannot identify a viable issue for appeal. And perhaps the client might write something that says, well, here's what the client wants to challenge. If, however, the attorney identifies an issue that's worthy of writing a brief, a viable issue for appeal, if the error is obvious, then our attorney will call up the attorney general and try and discuss the issue and say, look, this is such a clear error. Why do we have to go through briefing? Can we just somehow settle this by a state concession, by the attorney general conceding error, or a joint remand that sends the case back to the trial court? But most cases are resolved by our office filing a brief and the attorney general responding with a brief. And if the Court of Appeals affirms, ultimately, we will petition the Oregon Supreme Court should the client want that. I next would like to discuss some key budget drivers. And this will be an easy one. This is on page 27 of our materials. And if you look at that box graph at the bottom of the page, you'll see that our case assignments, so cases that we're assigning to our attorneys in the office, has gone up dramatically from 2001-03 biennium, beginning in the 05-07 biennium. It's a dramatic increase. And the question is, well, what's the cause of that? And the answer is predominantly a U.S. Supreme Court case called Blakely v. Washington. And I don't know how familiar the members of the committee are with Blakely, but Blakely was a tsunami with respect to sentencing issues in Oregon. If those states that had a sentencing guideline structure that was similar to what the federal government was using, if that system was in place, the Blakely, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and Blakely said, well, whatever fact that might increase, that a judge is going to use to increase a sentence, a jury, a defendant has a right to have a jury finding on that fact beyond a reasonable doubt. That opinion sent shockwaves through all the state jurisdictions that had sentencing guidelines, and we were virtually swamped with Blakely cases, and you'll see that in the 05-07 case assignments. We worked with the Court of Appeals and the Attorney General to try to work with this huge number of cases, and what we were able to do was identify lead cases for certain legal issues and then identify those cases that would fall within that category. So we'd identify a lead case and tell the Court of Appeals and, you know, the Attorney General, and we would tell the Court of Appeals, here's a lead case, and then we'd identify the 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 cases that fell into that category, and the Court of Appeals would resolve that lead case, and with respect to the other cases, we would file a modified brief. So we didn't go through full briefing. We were able to ask the court to waive some appellate rules and allow us to file a more simple brief. So that was one way that we dealt with the Blakely tsunami. We're also working with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals recently agreed to support a bill that we have, and I hope this committee will remember it when it comes before it, but it's House Bill 2667. And our request there is that the legislature eliminate and what we consider to be an unnecessary motion practice in parole board cases. So the point here is that we work with the Attorney General's office and we work with the courts with respect to streamlining and making the system more efficient. Excuse me.
Could you explain that to us again, what changes taking place there in the parole board hearing?
Sure.
We did pass that out of judiciary, I believe.
I think actually it's on Thursday's docket. But the parole board, I think it was 2001, the legislature passed a statute that said in parole board cases, before a parolee can even file a brief, the parolee has to file a motion, and the motion will say, here's the substantial question of law in this parole case. And the Attorney General has the option of agreeing or opposing. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals has to rule on that motion. And what we found is an average time delay was 4 months before the Court of Appeals would rule on that motion, and yet two-thirds of our motions were being allowed. And from our perspective, we viewed that as really unnecessary, because what it meant for us is that an attorney would pick up a case, review the whole case, and write a motion, and then 4 months, 5 months later, the attorney would have to go back to that case and then brief it. And we just saw that motion practice as really unnecessary and delaying the appeal. And so we have House Bill 2667 that's actually before the House Judiciary Committee on Thursday. And now the Court of Appeals is in support of our bill, and they too agree that this motion practice is unnecessary and makes the system tardy.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Peter. So would the net effect be to collapse it, so you file your brief and you file your motion with your brief?
It would eliminate the motion practice completely.
Okay.
So what we would do is just file the brief.
Okay.
You know, if we couldn't talk, if it's a meritorious case,
okay,
we would file a brief at that time.
Okay.
I'd like to move on to actually two things. Key performance measure number one.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman,
sorry.
Before we do, could you return to page 27?
Sure.
After the tsunami, it seems like the water level has been maintained.
Yeah.
Can you help us understand why the water level hasn't gone down?
we wondered about that too. And what we think has happened is that in prior biennium, well, let me start from what might be the beginning. In 2001, the legislature passed a statute that said in certain types of cases, a notice of appeal cannot be filed without an identification of a culpable claim of error. And those types of cases were guilty plea cases, no contest cases, and probation violation cases. So they weren't trial, what we call trial-type cases. They were plea-type cases. After Blakely, every case potentially had an issue because there's a sentence imposed in every case. And if there was a departure sentence imposed, that case had an issue. A departure sentence would be a sentence, an enhanced sentence above what the baseline would be for a conviction. As a result of Blakely, the unpreserved error, I apologize if I'm getting too technical, but cases that had an error that was unpreserved, which means nobody objected below in the trial court, those cases have now been resolved by the Supreme Court, and I think it was in 06 that they are resolved. But there are still plenty of other Blakely issues that have not been resolved, and those are issues where there is preservation, where an attorney did object to what the trial court did. And even absent Blakely, I mean, this is a fact of life of appellate law, that appeals will increase every time the legislature meets and enacts laws, because laws, criminal laws, will be challenged. And, you know, it's something to consider with respect to changing criminal laws and adding new laws and new crimes and stuff, because they will be challenged. And so in response to Blakely, as in many other jurisdictions, this legislature in 05 passed Senate Bill 528, which was a legislative response to Blakely, and it was a mechanism put in place to comply with Blakely. But of course, since it's major legislation, there will be challenges to it. Now, my understanding is that the prosecutors are and the defense attorneys are relatively happy with Senate Bill 528, but nonetheless, there will be challenges, because whenever there's major legislation, there are different issues and different aspects of the legislation that create questions that only the courts can answer.
Does that make sense?
This is perfect legislation. I just came in, but I will tell you that much.
Does that make sense to the civil attorney on the...
To the extent that any of this makes sense.
Great.
Just need more judges as well. Well, all he's saying is that it's a moving, if I may, Mr. Chair. You know, the sands are ever shifting, and the precedents built on this part of the sand sometimes shift and causes great impact on the House of the Judiciary.
That's right.
Especially related to water masters. I know those water masters.
Now, we could have saved a lot of money if we didn't pass Senate Bill 528. Is that correct?
Probably.
Great. Please continue with your...
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to discuss now perhaps what might seem like an odd combination, and that is key performance measure number one, and we identified reducing our backlog, because our agency historically has had a backlog of cases, and a backlog case is a case that we have not briefed within 210 days of the case coming into our office. Now, in the ideal world, 210 days is still way too long, but that's where we establish what a backlog case would be. And as you can see, it's on page 28 of our materials. Our targets, we have not met our targets. In fact, we've increased. Our backlog has increased. It's holding steady right now. And so I'd like to talk about that in conjunction with Policy Package 101, which is commensurate compensation for our attorneys. And I would imagine the committee might be thinking, well, Mr. Gartland, if you can't meet your key performance measures, why would you be asking for commensurate compensation? See shaking heads. And the reason is that, in my opinion, our attorneys have acted incredibly well. Our production rate has gone up in the past 2 years. And, in fact, I think Mary Williams, the Solicitor General, was in here a couple of months ago asking for additional staff because there had been an increase of our legal services division production, our output. And indeed, there's been significant. Our attorneys have really come to the fore and put their shoulder to the wheel and really produced incredibly well over the last 2 years. But the main reason why Policy Package 101 should be passed is that it's the right thing to do. It's very simple. It's the right thing to do. I mean, it's odd. I don't know how one can justify two government attorneys on either side of a case and getting disparate compensation. It's just patently unequal. For instance, I've brought a brief in. So in this case, you can see we have the state of Oregon represented by the Department of Justice, and we have Ms. Tompkins represented by our agency. And our attorneys are compensated close to like 25% less than the Attorney General's office, and it's very difficult to justify. I really can't think of any justification that would support that inequality.
And Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Wessler.
And the AG's office isn't exactly lavishly compensated. So your 25% less is a reduced number, although valid comparison.
Okay. Rhetorical question. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm struggling a bit to kind of get a sense of what the workload is, and I understand that it's high, but I've only done two briefs in my life. Uh-huh. One I won, and one was AWOP. But when you say you've got 24 FTP doing a brief, can you give me a sense of what the
sure.
briefing schedule is? You know, are they doing 5 briefs a month? You know, and maybe paint a picture a little bit for these folks too of what that's like for people.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'd be happy to do that. Let me start with some national models and then a survey of other states and what happens there. The Department of Justice funded a survey, I think it was 2001, and came out with a recommendation that appellate attorneys do 24 cases a year. In actuality, the range is actually 24 to 50 nationwide. Our attorneys have been at the 50 rate. So our attorneys are not, I don't want to mislead the committee. I'm not saying our attorneys are writing 50 cases a year, 50 briefs a year, but they're resolving 50 cases a year. And so that resolution may come in talking somebody out of an appeal, filing a motion to dismiss, filing a Balfour brief, or filing a brief on the merits. So, but we are at national levels, high national levels, and I'm really proud of our attorneys. I don't, particularly the last couple of years, have really been exemplary.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Another reason for Policy Package 101 is that it would be consistent with ORS 151216-1E, which directs that the commission, the Public Defense Services Commission, is to adopt the compensation plan that is commensurate with other state agencies. And again, the Attorney General's office is our direct counterpart. So approving Policy Package 101 would be consistent with that statutory directive. Finally, and I hope it's probably obvious, but we are able to recruit, we've been able to recruit really good attorneys, I think, young attorneys. But we recruit young attorneys and we train them. And what we found is that after 3 or 4 or 5 years, once they become really good appellate attorneys, guess what? They leave. And if we could improve the salary structure, it would really assist us in retaining the good attorneys. And good, experienced attorneys are very efficient, very productive, so our backlog would continue to go down, and they're effective, which means that they're going to get better results, and the clients are going to be more satisfied. So the number of complaints will go down. It's for us, it's a win-win, because our goal is to help the system, help our clients, and, you know, that's having a decent salary compensation would assist us in to those ends. And finally, just want to point out the cost of Policy Package 101 is $350,659 for the biennium. So it's not an exorbitant amount, but it would really assist us in the short and long run.
And colleagues, the amounts for the policy option packages are on page 2 earlier in the binder if you're interested in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garland, can you describe for me, we talked about some efficiencies or some measurement indicators here. Is there anything tied to their compensation based on their performance to these same indicators?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, thank you. Yes, we a couple of years ago, we went to a merit system. And so we promote people based upon their contribution. So, and that's essentially breaks down to production and quality. And we are trying to institute more a different system that will measure, even within that, a more nuanced measurement. So it would be assessing not just the number of cases that they've addressed or the number of briefs that they filed, but how long was the transcript? How many issues were raised? How complex were the issues? Was the case argued? Because that takes a lot of time to prepare for oral argument. Was the attorney successful? We want to measure a lot of those different individual aspects of being an appellate attorney, and we promote people based upon their production and the quality of the representation. And we're serious about that. And it works. I would say that we have a very healthy atmosphere and environment in the office. I'm really pleased with it. It's collaborative. We want each other to do well. And it's also competitive in a very good way because people want to do well and people are aware of what other people are doing. So it's I don't know if anybody's been on a sports team, but it's kind of similar to being on a really good sports team, where people are competing with each other because they want to play more, but they have the team, the goal of winning as the ultimate goal. I mean, it's a fine line, but when it's there and it works, it's really productive.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move on to other appeals that the Office of Public Defense Services funds. And I think that'll be on a chart on page 26. So that chart, that largest section of the pie are criminal cases, and far and away the majority of those, overwhelming majority, are done by our office. Some are not if we have conflicts or cases that for some reason or another we cannot represent a client, we will send them out. But the overwhelming majority of that criminal part of the pie is Legal Services Division. The next biggest piece is I'm going to leave that for last, but the next piece I'd like to address is the juvenile piece. And in juvenile law, there are two main case types. One is a delinquency, and a delinquency is the equivalent of a juvenile violating a criminal law. So if the juvenile had been an adult, the juvenile could have been prosecuted for a violation of a criminal law. The other one are called dependency and termination of parental rights. Dependency cases are when the court is asked to decide, a trial court is asked to decide whether or not a child should be within the court's jurisdiction. In other words, is that child at risk such that the state needs to step in and do something and take that child into custody? And ultimately, those cases can result in what's called termination of parental rights. And, of course, termination of parental rights means that a court has determined that that child is in jeopardy and danger, and that the parents are, you know, their conduct is so egregious that they should no longer be the legal parent of that child. Both the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Judicial Department Juvenile Court Improvement Project have identified appeals in juvenile cases as a troublesome area that requires some remedial treatment. And most of the attorneys in this area are paid at the hourly rate of $40 an hour. And I'm not going to touch this too much because Chief Judge Brewer is going to be here a little bit later, and he's going to testify as to the need for some sort of structure, a different program. And what this contemplates is that there would be four attorneys placed in our office to do the appeals. And what that would do is centralize the appeals and impose some structure in the area. But just Chief Judge Brewer will address that later. That's Policy Package 100. The next piece is civil commitments. And again, civil commitment, all the attorneys who do appeals in this area are compensated at $40 an hour. In a civil commitment hearing, I'll describe perhaps briefly. In a civil commitment hearing, a question for the court is whether or not the individual is mentally ill and poses a danger to him or herself or others. So that's the question, and if the court decides yes, that person is entitled to challenge that ruling by the trial court. Finally, I'd like to address post-conviction relief. Post-conviction relief is not a criminal claim. It's not a criminal case. It involves an underlying criminal conviction, but it itself is not a criminal case. And typically, I'll run through the system a little bit. If somebody's convicted of a crime, they have a right to appeal, and they can challenge that conviction. And what the appellate courts are looking at on direct appeal is whether or not the judge made an error that affected the fairness of the proceeding or the sentence. After that direct appeal is completed, that defendant can go into civil law and file a post-conviction relief claim. It's a suit. A judge will look over the claim, decide whether or not it states a culpable claim of error or some standard like that, and appoint an attorney. And then the attorney, the responsibilities of the attorney are to most often look at the representation provided by trial counsel and appellate counsel. And if that attorney can establish that the trial counsel or the appellate counsel provided inadequate assistance of counsel such that that proceeding was tainted, it was flawed, then the post-conviction court can give remedy to that individual. It might be, well, okay, we'll go back and we'll start over as if somebody has just been indicted and that person now stands in a position of either pleading or going to trial. Or if the flaw occurred on the appellate level, the post-conviction trial court could order a remedy of, okay, you will get another appeal. So, but it's actually a very, very challenging area of law. And the Oregon State Bar and anecdotal information seem to indicate that, yes, that again is another area of law that needs to be improved. The representation from court-appointed attorneys need to be improved. And it's interesting. It's easy to understand why that would occur, because it's a very complex animal. Because, again, it's a combination of criminal and civil law. the post-conviction attorney must be familiar with the civil rules of procedure. And yet, in order to spot flaws by the attorneys in either the criminal trial or the direct appeal, this attorney must also be familiar and conversant in criminal, substantive, and procedural law. So it's a complicated area, and so it's a very challenging area. And there's a policy package, I believe it's 102, again, would place four attorneys in the Office of Public Defense Services, and with the idea being that with some sort of centralization, we could improve the quality of representation in the post-conviction area and impose some sort of a structure, uniformity, some sort of a structure that could feed other attorneys practicing in the area and give them more guidance.
Yeah. Senator Brown.
Peter, just to clarify, so do you have some attorneys doing this now, or is this all being contracted out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, yes, this is all being contracted out. There are no Office of Public Defense Services employees who are doing post-conviction relief.
Okay.
And if I might add, there's another consideration, and that is right now there are a lot of death penalty cases in Marion County. And I think there's a concern about are there enough experienced attorneys to do this kind of case, because it's very challenging. And so I think an idea would be that some of these attorneys, the four attorneys that we're requesting in Policy Package 102, would ultimately be doing a death penalty post-conviction case or cases. And actually, I have no, unless there are other questions, I don't have anything else other than to introduce, I hope.
Yeah.
Actually, Chief Judge Brewer was going to be here, and he's not here yet. But I'd like to call Pat Birmingham. Pat Birmingham is a prominent criminal defense attorney in Portland, and he's agreed to come down and testify for us.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Pat Birmingham, and I'm on the private retained side of this equation. I'd kind of like to give a brief contrast between the world of the private retained criminal defense lawyer and that of the court-appointed or public defender. I began my career 32 years ago as a public defender in California. In 1979, I moved back to...
You bring the microphone just a little closer. Okay.
In 1979, I moved back to Oregon. I began the private practice of law. And in the 1980s, I did court-appointed work. And at that time, we were being paid $30 an hour. I was in private practice, but I took conflicts and the occasional court-appointed case. But even in the 80s, it soon became apparent that I really couldn't afford to do court-appointed work. Currently, I have an office in downtown Portland. I'm in a partnership, Birmingham and Mackeson, two lawyers. We have a nice but modest office in the Congress Center in downtown Portland. And I looked at my records for last year, and in order to keep my doors open, I have to generate $70 an hour overhead. For my partner, that would be $140 for the firm. If I were to take a court-appointed caseload at $40 an hour, I would lose close to $5,000 a month. The firm would lose close to $10,000 a month. If I were to do court-appointed death penalty cases, I would lose about $2,500 a month. And this is before I pay any salary to myself or health insurance. This is just to keep the doors open. My secretary, legal assistant, receptionist, we have one employee. She answers the phone, does our secretarial work. We pay her a competitive base salary of $48,000 a year, full benefits, health insurance, parking, TriMet. it's expensive to run a practice in downtown Portland. It's $200 a month for a parking spot. I was looking at the paperwork here, and we have public defenders being hired at $38,000 a year. I could not find somebody in private practice to go to work for me for $38,000 a year. It's more in the range of 55 to 60. The contrast is just, I find it almost hard to fathom. For instance, the court-appointed rate for private investigators is $25 per hour and $37 per hour if they're working on a death penalty case. My private investigator charges me $75 an hour and 50 cents a mile. I recently hired a forensic expert to do a crime scene investigation. I'm being charged $195 an hour, and I believe the court-appointed rate is about $100 an hour. But that's a non-lawyer being paid double, or more than double, what the court-appointed lawyers are being paid. So what I see in my practice, I go to court on misdemeanor pretrial hearings where we're supposed to negotiate cases and settle cases. I'll show up with my client, having spent a couple hours with my client, having investigated the case. I'm ready to settle the case or announce the case for trial. Ahead of me, oftentimes, will be a contract lawyer or a public defender with 10 or 15 or 20 files. They end up setting those cases over for another date because they haven't had time to meet with their clients. In fact, it's a common occurrence. Almost every time I go to the courthouse, court-appointed clients come up and say, "Are you Mr. So-and-so?" They're looking for their attorney. They've never met their attorney. The caseload that these folks have is just unbelievable. And that translates into inefficiency. If they're not ready at pretrial, the case gets set over. It gets set over, and you're paying whatever that hourly rate is over and over again. Whereas most private lawyers can settle the case that day. Mr. Gartland just mentioned post-conviction relief hearings, and that's kind of a touchy subject for me because for 25, close to 30 years, I never had any client file a post-conviction relief against me. Now I've had several cases where contract lawyers have filed petitions in court, public record, claiming that I didn't investigate the case, I didn't call witnesses, I was inadequate, I was incompetent, whatever. Then I find out that they've never read the transcript. If they would have took the time or had the time to read the transcript, they would have known that the petition was patently false. And I can give you details on at least two of these situations where the lawyers filed these petitions making claims without having read the trial transcript or, I suspect, having really talked to their clients. And I suspect it's because they get a couple hundred dollars to do a job that requires several thousand dollars. I'm seeing that in the private practice, there are less and less young lawyers that even want to go into criminal law in the private sector. I've been a mentor for the Multnomah County Bar Association for the past 10, 11 years. And what the Multnomah County Bar Association does is they try to line up young lawyers or newly admitted lawyers who have an interest in personal injury, family law, environmental law, and they pair them with an older, experienced attorney for a year's time. They've kept a couple slots for criminal people interested in criminal defense, only a couple because there's not that many people that are partaking of the program. Out of about 10 or 11 mentees, I can only name one that's still doing criminal defense work. In fact, this year, there wasn't enough interest among lawyers wanting to do criminal defense work to even pair me up with someone that wanted to do criminal defense work. The cost of doing business is extreme. I don't know how the system continues to function when court-appointed lawyers are making $40 to $50 an hour, when running a modest law practice, you know, costs a lawyer at least $70 an hour to keep the doors open. Thank you.
Testimony, Mr. Birmingham. Any questions? Next on the agenda, Judge Brewer.
Thanks very much, Chair Shields. David Brewer, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Your Honor.
See you all again today. Today I'm here to talk about something other than the judicial branch directly. I've been asked to chat with you for a few minutes about a very important issue for me and I think for this committee and for the entire legislature, and that's the quality of representation in juvenile dependency and termination of parental rights cases on appeal for children and families, and the priority that the courts and we think the legislature should assign to these cases. One of the things that I think you may not hear as much as I would like to say is how important it is, it's a truism, but how important it is for all aspects of the criminal justice system to be viewed just as that, a system, where in order to have a fully functioning integral whole, you have to take care of all of the parts of it. And in particular, I'm very concerned about the quality of representation we're seeing on appeal in termination of parental rights cases and in dependency appeals, and how it affects the appellate court's exercise of their review and our ability to get at just and proper and timely results in these cases. You've heard a lot, and I heard just a very eloquent discussion just now about the effect that we now have in the system on quality of representation based on some compensation issues. When it comes to the future of kids, nothing could be important than getting the best lawyers we can get at a reasonable and affordable rate. Right now, the work that's being done, the indigent defense work that's being done for parents and for children, for that matter, in termination of parental rights cases, is being done by the private bar. Albeit under the supervision of Ms. Swenson and Mr. Gartland's office, the people that do the work are all private lawyers. Some of them are truly doing incredible work because they absolutely believe in the importance of the work and they would do it for free. We have a very few people that fit that category. Unfortunately, the majority of the representation we see at $40 an hour in this area is being done by folks who frankly are trying to pay the lights and who are running in some ways garage practices or home practices with very little staff. And the quality of representation, folks, really shows through big time. What we see in de novo review cases, which means the appellate court, of course, reviews the case fresh on the record, often is a 50-page brief that simply repeats the testimony of what happened before the trial court in a termination case and doesn't adequately explain how that testimony relates to legal issues before the court. The court has to try to sort all of that out. The job is also much more difficult for the Attorney General's office when in the vast majority of these cases the state is the respondent to try to sort out what the appellant is actually trying to say and the points that are trying to be made to make some sense of that work. A couple of years ago, the Pew Charitable Foundation held a conference back in Minnesota to deal with this and other related issues involving juveniles. And all 50 states, chief justices from all 50 states of the United States were represented at this conference. And the primary focus was a national recognition of how difficult it is to get timely quality results in termination of parental rights cases and get permanency for children and families as quickly as possible without sacrificing justice. There was an Oregon team that went. It included trial judges. It included representatives of DHS. And I was there as the head of that contingent. And what we did when we got back is we came away, quite frankly, fired up about the idea of improving the quality of justice on appeals in these cases. And thanks to Senator Brown, Representative Krieger, Representative Schaffler, and others, we formed the first cross-branch work group that I know of its kind in the country to try to get at quality issues system-wide when it comes to this critical work. Again, recognizing you can't treat part of an issue without considering the effect elsewhere. What we came up with was the pervasiveness of quality of representation issues at every single level. And it didn't take too long, just a few months into this work group, for members of the legislative group, the executive branch group, and the judicial group to recognize how much improved the situation would be if we could have the institutional defender take over the representation of this work, just as it's being done in criminal cases for the most part. As you've heard, not as is being done in post-conviction cases, but has been done in criminal cases. The quality of work we see from OPDS is sterling across the board. If there ever is a problem, we have accountable people to help us deal with that problem and fix it right away. The problems that exist in the system are endemic problems relating to resources and funding. But given what OPDS has to work with, nobody in the country, in my opinion, does a better job. And so I've been asked to advocate to you the importance of supporting the POPS package that OPDS has forwarded to you, asking for 4 additional full-time lawyers to handle, on behalf of parents and families, the appellate work in dependency and termination of parental rights cases. Allowing lawyers to specialize in juvenile appeals and to develop expertise that could be shared with other attorneys who don't help them as handle those cases as frequently will improve the quality of practice all across the board, will make the work easier for the courts, will make the work easier for the Attorney General's office, will get at tough issues quicker and help the court and the opposing party focus on what matters. These folks can also be a much better resource for trial attorneys, helping them identify emerging legal issues and preserve them for review. So you get a cross-training benefit as well, and mentoring that comes from having the institutional defender do the work, as opposed to having it done piecemeal by private representation. So we're really pleased with what the work group has done. We think this is a vital part of it, and we urge you to approve this package and to get the institutional defender involved with this work. I've gone on, and I apologize. I could go on a lot more, but I'll stop, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to talk to you about those.
Any questions? Judge, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Senator Westland. Appreciate your time.
I do have a question.
Sure.
In DHS, we're trying to get some additional funding to Adult and Family Services when they, legal representation for the caseworkers when they first appear before the circuit court judges with regard to child termination cases. I mean, quite frankly, and I've been here a number of years, I had no idea that they were unrepresented in these legal matters. Functionally, the state's interest was unrepresented by legal counsel. Right? Isn't that, it's just incredulous to me. And I guess I'm not asking for a response. If you've got one, great. But I was recently made aware of that. You're talking about a team and holistic and all the parts. Here's a part that's egregiously, underrepresented. I mean, you've got a caseworker that underpaid, overworked, trying to make a statement in, a legal setting.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I'm going to be careful how I answer this because people far more qualified than I'm sure, have already testified concerning this and will before your work is done. But as a former trial judge, I can tell you that having handled termination cases and being a backup juvenile court judge in Lane County for 6 years, you're absolutely right. People tend to think of the state as a monolith, right? They tend to think of the interests of the agency, of the Attorney General's office, is coinciding in every respect. Frequently they do, but not always. You see the same issue arise when it comes to CASAS on behalf of children. There's a sense that, well, you've got a lawyer representing the child, so why do you need a CASA too? The truth is that the system is taxed to the hilt at every level. And by having a little bit more of a belt and suspenders approach, you make the most out of the situation by ensuring that the right information gets to the court, that the agency has enough resources to adequately set out its position, and we come a lot closer to getting at the truth, which is really all that matters in these cases. You know, we function in an adversary system where the courts necessarily have to rely on the quality of representation of all sides in order to get at the evidence. That's the system we've had from time immemorial, and it only works when all of the players, to the extent their interests diverge, are adequately represented. We don't live in an era or a time, nor will we ever, of unlimited resources. We know better than that. On the other hand, there needs to be, in my view, more targeted, specific attention paid to all of the components of this system to the extent that their interests differ, and to make sure that they have appropriate representation. So I'm on your page.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to juvenile dependency appeals, because there has been insufficient, I should choose my words carefully so I don't get us in trouble, but we haven't had the level of legal advice or representation available in juvenile dependency cases, advice or consultation available to caseworkers before court or in court. Would we have the level of appeals we have now, and would we have a request for this number of additional persons to handle appeals if we had a different level investment, in other words, a greater investment at the front end?
Chair Shields and Representative Nathanson, that's a wonderful question, and the answer is necessarily speculative. But I can tell you this. If you took the approach that you and Senator Westland have described, along with several other targeted, specific measures, some of which have been identified in our appellate work group, including an active mediation program in these cases at the trial court level statewide, not varying dramatically county to county, you bet. You would have a lot more cases disposed of at an earlier stage at less expense to the system, and you'd reduce the need, I think, in the long run for appellate resources. But it's in the long run. And it would require, I think, again, Representative Nathanson, a much more systematic approach than we've historically taken with this. And what you're describing would be one important piece of it.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to just the prerogative of the chair to keep us on track here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Mr. Connors, do you want to testify?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Connors, and I'm the County Director of the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. The Metropolitan Public Defender is the oldest and biggest public defender's office in the state. In the Portland office, we have about 45 lawyers and about 100 staff handling 13,000 cases a year. We handle the full range of cases, both juvenile delinquency and dependency cases. We've got 9 lawyers doing that. We've got a misdemeanor group handling the wide range of misdemeanor cases, 9 lawyers in that group. We've got a minor felony group with 9 lawyers. They handle primarily drug cases and property crimes. We've got a major felony group that handles the Measure 11 cases, murder cases. Some of the lawyers in the office are now second chairing death penalty cases. There are several of us that have those cases. And we've got a special courts group that handles community court, the STOP program, which is the drug treatment court in Multnomah County, and domestic violence diversion and the civil commitments. It's a very big, busy place. Also, by way of background, I wanted to mention 2 other things. We really try to not just be good legal technicians, but we work in a holistic sense to counsel the clients to do things to get out of the system. We're very involved in finding alternatives and getting them in things like anger management and employment training, those sorts of things. And we've also been very involved in the Multnomah County system. It's a good county for collaborative work, problem solving. Our office is at monthly meetings on a wide range of issues, trying to make the system work better. I've been asked to talk about two things, recruitment and retention. I'll talk about the easier one first. Recruitment, quite frankly, is not that big a problem for us right now. The biggest reason for that is we operate on a pool process. We typically lose about 10 lawyers a year. We don't get much notice of that. We've got to get the caseloads filled. So twice a year we interview anywhere between 8 to 12 lawyers in one day. We usually put 6 or 7 of them in the pool. That means if we've got 10 openings a year, the odds are pretty good we'd be able to fill the positions. I will say there's been a trend toward more and more lawyers being from the local schools. We get fewer national applicants, the much bigger problem is the length of time people stay. And retention is a huge problem for us. And to really understand why it's such a big problem, you sort of have to know a little bit about the typical learning curve in our office. And it's a really fast one. Lawyers generally start in the office in misdemeanors. They're there anywhere between 12 to 18 months. From there, they'll move to handle felony cases, the drug and property cases, and hopefully they're there anywhere between 12 to 18 months, which means at 3 years, they're handling Measure 11 cases and murder cases. We try to not to give them a murder case at 3 years. We make them second chair one, but it's a very, very steep learning curve, and it's in a real contrast to, say, a DA's office where people handling murder cases are typically there somewhere between 10 and 20 years. We think it works for a lot of different reasons, but it's a tough learning curve. And where we're really getting hurt is over the last 3 to 5 years, typically we're losing about half of every entry class. In other words, if we hired 10 lawyers 3 years ago, we've lost 5 of them. And it means, you know, literally we're thinning the ranks, and we're not having people that can step up and handle the more serious cases. We've survived because we had a pretty senior staff. We've got offices in 2 counties. We've been able to move people. We had people with a lot of experience handling the civil commitments, and we can move them. But I think we're really getting to a critical situation. And the main reason people are leaving are financial reasons. They're willing to take a job because there's trial work and it's interesting and they want a job. But once they're there 2 years and they realize they can't pay their loans or they can't pay their mortgage or they can't have any kids, they leave. And they leave to go a variety of different places, but they leave, and it's really starting to hurt us, especially when you contrast our level of experience with that of the DA's office. One other aspect, it's sort of the double whammy for us, was the whole BRAC situation back in 2003. We had a hiring freeze for about 18 months. It lasted probably a little bit more than that, where we didn't hire anybody for those 18 months. And we're really starting to pay a price in terms of the leadership in the office. We've got 6 attorney managers that run the different sections I talked about. Right now I've got 3 attorney managers that don't have significant felony experience, that haven't handled a murder case, and that's just not right. That's not the kind of leadership we need in a big, busy public defender's office. And like I said, it's in extreme contrast to the DA's office. The other thing that plays into all this is the caseloads. Historically, at least since I've been director the last 17 years, typically the way we got money for cost of living increases was to take more cases. And I think Robin Lamont's made some, there's been some suggestion that part of the way to deal with that is that we no longer be looked at as goods and services, and we actually get cost of living increases built into our budgeting process, and that will be a very helpful thing. But there's a huge gap. We are pretty much across the board pay 30% less than the district attorneys in our county. People can't pay back school loans and things along those lines. And where we ended up about 4 years ago was with caseloads in the minor felony group that should be no more than 80 or 90 cases, up in the neighborhood 150 to 160. People just can't get the cases done when they're trying to find their clients and just babysit the files. There are other things that played into that. the sheriff's matrix system, and we had some trouble keeping track of our clients, but that was just the caseloads were too big to really do any effective work on them. That situation got better in part because we moved lawyers from other parts of the office, but they paid a price. And for the last 2 years, our misdemeanor caseloads, which should be no more than 100 open cases at a time, have been in the neighborhood of 150 to 160. And again, that's just not right. It's way over the national standards, and it's part of the problem that we are hoping to address with increased financial resources. I've had the pleasure to serve as the president of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association for the last year. As part of that job, I've gotten to travel around the state and hear about a problem described as the graying of the defense bar, and I've heard presiding judges in places like Curry County and Coos County and Jackson County say, you know, look, we're just not seeing people coming in to do this kind of work. And I can tell you that that's specifically a problem within my office in terms of the actual infrastructure of people handling these cases, and it's getting to be a crisis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connors. Questions? Before you go, I was looking at the budget drivers, and one just kind of jumped out at me, number three, and I think you could probably answer this one as well as Ms. Swenson, but it says changes in law enforcement policies, including, you know, trespassing and drug-free zones. My understanding in how those works is that, or one of the ways that the district attorney's office has talked about it is the way that it's a way to save money, because you're not sending somebody to jail, you're just excluding them from a particular area. Can you tell me how that would result in increased costs to your office?
Well, in my experience, that's not how things happen, and there are some clients in a frequent study by the Multnomah County Sheriff within the last 5 years that suggested some people had been arrested as many as 90 times on criminal trespass charges. So it's a huge cost factor to our system, and that's how I see that issue playing out, that people do get arrested.
When they come back in for criminal trespass.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Connor, you described not exactly what your turnover rate was, but I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking about through your description, it's about a 25% turnover rate of your attorneys.
It's a little different every year. Traditionally, it's been about 10 lawyers a year.
Out of 45.
Well, and there's another 20 in Washington County, so 65.
Out of 65.
Right.
Okay. So we don't know the exact turnover rate, but I'm just basing that on your description. Is it your perception that the increase that's being proposed will reduce that by X? I mean, do you have a thought in your mind of what that does?
Yes. Traditionally, lawyers stayed at least 5 years. Typically, often stayed 10 years, and There were sort of distinct breakpoints. I think what this would do would stop people from leaving at 2 years and 3 years, just as they're becoming, you know, able to handle the more serious cases and to put it real directly, more useful to us and more useful to the system.
Just as a follow-up, I think your testimony is incredibly important. As important as whatever your turnover rate would be, your average tenure, so that we fully understand in entry-level, I don't know your business, but entry-level misdemeanor attorneys, you have a elevated level of turnover rate, but in your more senior staff, your tenure is actually much longer, and we don't know that. So just for our benefit, understanding how that works and what the average tenure is, I think would be helpful for us to understand. And further, what the increase, you know, what the goal is in order for it to do. I mean, if we knew today that your turnover rate was 30% and the projection was by increasing to X the salary, you're going to show it be 20%, we could do the math. But some of this seems subjective, and I find that hard to get a grip of. It sounds good. It's a pay increase for everybody, and that's good, but let's get let's get some teeth in what we're talking about.
Right, right. No, that makes perfect sense. And anecdotally, I could tell you, I was part of a group that did an ends of court presentation on this issue, and I talked to the head of legal aid in Multnomah County, and he said their experience is the exact same thing, that they don't have trouble getting people in the door, but it's keeping them past 2 or 3 years. So,
yeah. Well, thank you again. Great testimony.
Thank you.
And I can, just from my experience, having worked with people in recovery from addiction and probationers and parolees, the DAs I worked with are still in the district attorney's office, and I can think, I mean, you've got Metropolitan Public Defenders who are now working at Allstate, who are now working...
DAG's office, you name it, they're there.
In private practice. I don't think there's one that I've known since I moved here in 96 that's still there. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Representative, I just also wanted to point out, I think it was Mr. Birmingham who said he paid his legal assistant $48,000. That's what I got paid at Juvenile Rights Project after working for 10 years in the field and an 85 barn member, which means I've been out for a long time. And I just think that's a really good comparative of, you know, sort of private sector, public sector, and why people would stay and not stay. So.
And keep in mind, my comments aren't negative.
I know.
They're simply...
Yeah.
It's hard to sit here and subjectively say, here's what this means. I may be the only one, but for me, when you can say we're going to take a turnover rate from here to here by doing this, it's much easier to answer the question. That's my only point. It's not negative in any way, shape, or form. It's simply I'd like to get a hold of the number.
Mr. Connors, I mean, is there any way to make an educated guess on if we? I mean, I know that. I don't know. It would be pretty subjective to say if we increased salaries by, if we doubled salaries, the turnover would go down by X percent. is there any way we could quantify that?
I would be glad to go back and check with our executive director and the HR person and, you know, run those numbers over the last 10 years and try to come up with more discrete turnover rates.
Mr. Headings, I think, may have a... Why don't you come up to the...
I'm Jim Hennings. I'm the executive director, and we have those numbers. I don't have them with me today, but I will give them to you tomorrow.
Okay.
For the professional staff.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you for your
Thank
testimony.
You.
Anything else, Ms. Hudson?
Mr. Chair, since we have just a couple minutes, maybe I could respond to the question we received yesterday from Representative Hanna about turnover rates. And basically, I had reported that our contractors said the time to fill a vacancy was approximately twice what it was in 1999, which was the earlier date we inquired about. And you asked, well, doubled from what to what? Mm-hmm. And in this instance, I have to tell you that an average doesn't make a lot of sense because there is such a wide variety between the experiences of some of our contractors and others. We have a Medford contractor, for example, who keeps excellent records, and he could tell us that in 1999, it took 15 business days to fill a vacancy. And today, it takes him 32 business days to fill a vacancy. But he's really unusual. The other contractors, like Mr. Mallon told you yesterday, that, you know, he's got one vacancy that opened up in July. He hasn't filled it yet. And his only previous vacancy in recent years was 3 years ago. And that, fortunately, filled very quickly. But how can you, you know, assume that that was a comparable situation? It may well not have been. He might have gotten lucky 3 years ago and hasn't gotten lucky this time around. One of our Roseburg contractors has had a vacancy since December and is still trying to fill it. He's hopeful that in May, he's actually got some interviews scheduled in May and may be able to fill that. But his staff reported to us that it was normal in the past to fill those within a couple of months. Ms. Furlong testified yesterday about the two unfilled vacancies in the Deschutes County, Crabtree and Ramsdorf office. And her employer had reported that in the past it took about a month and a half. And he had, in 1999, he had five vacancies. It took on average a month and a half to fill those vacancies. And currently he had five vacancies. He filled four. He hasn't filled the other. And it took an average of 5 months in order to do that. So that's roughly triple the time. So what we did is just take all that, the anecdotal information we received, and estimated that it's about double. But in fact, the average doesn't help you very much.
Representative Mr. Chair, I'd just make a general comment. I think from the figures we saw yesterday and testimony we've heard today that obviously probably the right thing to do, regardless of the statistics and the facts, is to probably make some sort of an increase here. And I just want to make an observation that in everything we hear, not only about attorneys, but throughout this building, that there is a labor problem, and it is harder to get people to fill lots and lots of positions, whether we talk about the medical industry or we talk about engineering or we talk about attorneys. And so there's always a natural progression where somebody is an entry-level person and they have to start someplace. But I do want to make the observation that I've heard testimony that says there is something that's the right thing to do here to make a move someplace. And, we obviously want to do that, but also have statistics to track in the future. So.
Good comment. Anything else? Colleagues, I want to remind you that on Tuesday, May 1st, we will be meeting in Almsville Elementary from 5:30 to 7:30, a hearing on Head Start and how Head Start affects public safety. So if you care about Head Start, you should be there. If you care about public safety, you should be
there. I'll take you there in my pickup truck.
That's right. It's in Representative Cameron's district.
Riding back?
I'm not sure if that's legal or not.
I am serious. A lot of people will be traveling miles, struggling working families who will come there to testify, and I think it's really important that we're all there. This meeting is adjourned. Thanks.